Today's show is sponsored by Talari Networks and Thousand Eyes. Thanks to them.
Packet Pusher's weekly show is sponsored this week by Talari, innovator and SD-WAN leader that offers a thinking WAN solution that proactively manages network capacity, reliability, and performance so that you don't have to. Self-correcting and brilliant, Talari's solution frees IT administrators to innovate in new areas. Discover a better way to SD-WAN at talari.com.
Thousand Eyes delivers visibility into every network your organization relies on, from the data center to the cloud, so you can quickly and precisely pinpoint the root cause of network issues wherever they occur. Sign up for a free account at thousandeyes.com/packetpushers and choose a free Thousand Eyes t-shirt. This is the Packet Pushers podcast, the greatest data networking podcast on the planet, and depending on how you monitor these things. If you're a networking nerd, a data center heavy infrastructure engineer, or a self-styled rock star of the hot aisle, you've come to the right place to listen to information about networking. In this show, I'm talking about middle boxes. Now, for those of you who have been out there building DMZs in the enterprise or working for service providers who have been desperately trying to reduce traffic loads or do deep packet inspection and pretending that they can do quality of service, that's what we're talking about today. There are all sorts of ways to intercept the IP flows as they go across the network in the name of, well, something. Breaching privacy, stealing data, making money out of it. I'll point you to a blog post where Verizon makes $24 billion a year by selling off information of what traffic crosses their backbones. That's real money, no any way that you count it. So middle boxes are important. And in the enterprise, of course, middle boxes are critical to being able to intercept traffic so that you could log how many hours people are spending on Facebook. Or in my case, as I once told a financial trader, he should really get the Porsche instead of the BMW. It really was much better his style. These are the things that are happening in our networks today. These middle boxes intercept traffic, log it, and allow us to do stuff. The challenge is that encryption is going to take all that away. If we start to do end-to-end encryption, the model of middle boxes and the so-called values that they bring to the network will actually be dissipated and gone away. Fortunately, I ran across some research from Justine Sherry recently, and she is going to tell me about how middle box processing can live on into the future. So, first of all, welcome to the show, Justine.
Thanks, Greg. I do feel the need to defend the uses of middle boxes. I think you've given them a very unfair introduction.
Oh, well, it was a little one-eyed.
A little bit. Middle boxes, they are definitely used for evil, but they are also used for a wide range of uses that are pretty good, mostly security and performance related. So we're all familiar with caching and how useful that is in terms of cutting down on bandwidth costs, making things load faster. Intrusion detection is great, especially when you don't have control over the end hosts in your network. So being your own device or IoT devices don't really allow you to control what sort of botnet activity or malicious behavior is going on in your own network, and you can monitor all of that with an IDS. So I think middle boxes bring good with bad. I definitely have concerns about the privacy aspects that you brought up, but I think the reason they become so popular is not because anyone was going out saying, hey, I can spy on what everyone's doing, but because there really were good and useful features that network administrators were trying to give to their clients. They were trying to make things better.
How did you get into middle boxes? Tell me why you've got a thing about middle boxes.
So I'm a graduate student at UC Berkeley. I'm actually on the faculty job market right now, and middle boxes are my dissertation topic. And I think they're much more fun than traditional networking, where you're really focused on delivering packets from source to destination. But now you have all of the power of general purpose compute to do what you want to data as it going over the network.
I would agree with that. I think that connectivity is kind of like meh. It's commoditized, right? It's assumed that everything can be plugged into a network now. The argument is, how do we make the network better, faster, more visible, have a prettier front end?
You know, more secure.
I read this white paper saying future architectures for middle box processing services in the internet as cloud.
Right.
And we're talking about encryption as preventing this, right? So if everything's encrypted end to end, your IDS can't decode it unless you've got the private key. The only time you're going to have the private key is if you're in an enterprise where you can stuff a private key into the web browser in the certificate store or for the stuff. But you're talking about...
Or if you're a malicious government that already owns a certificate authority, or you're someone who's compromised a certificate authority.
Yes, well, I was going to leave some of those there, but you're quite right. Let's not argue about certificate authorities on the internet. It's pretty easy to crack.
They're pretty easy to declare that they're bad.
Well, there's over 100 CAs in the web browsers these days, and I think 20 of them are actually in China, owned by the Chinese government.
Right, right.
So,
well,
you know,
I'm looking forward to Google's certificate transparency stuff. I think that that's probably going to help somewhat. It's not going to fix everything, but it's going to ameliorate some of the danger.
I'm more excited about DNSSEC. The idea that you sign your DNS entries with your own key, and you can use that to do SSL.
I think that's great too.
That's a much lot more likely to be successful. So why are middle boxes so popular today? Why are people using them?
Middle boxes are really the only way to extend the functionality of networks. They're pretty great because you buy a box and you just drop it in somewhere in your network. You don't have to go through and replace all your routers and switches. So if I want to implement caching, I buy a box and I plug it in. If I want to implement transcoding, there's actually a recent study by folks at University of Southern California talking about how almost all of the major cell phone service providers will transcode images before you download them. That is, make them smaller so that they load faster and cost you less in terms of your bandwidth cap. And Middlebox is the only way to add on these sort of useful features in networking. I've talked already about security benefits, things like intrusion detection. But the bottom line is that if you're the guy controlling the network, this is the only place you have to deploy new things. You don't control the edge. And so if you want to assert any control over providing good performance or having some sort of security guarantees, you have to do it in the network. You can't go out and install software everywhere. And so that's why we've seen this proliferation of all of these devices.
Well, that's true, but the flip side of this, let me just take an antagonistic view.
Yeah,
there.
Do for it. Go for it.
If I look at smartphones, so my iPhone is only going to last 2 years before I'm probably going to replace it, or 4 years by the time it goes down, and then it'll be discarded. You're looking at operating systems to the desktop are now actually being force upgraded. Windows 10, for example,
right,
is, you know, hostilely upgrading older instances of Windows. What we're seeing is an increasing rate of change at the edge.
Right.
You're right. For the last 20 years, the only way we could modify traffic flows in the network was to do it in the network, because we could never modify what was at the edge of the network, because the edge of the network was stagnant like a swamp. It just took ages and ages to change. People didn't update from Windows XP for 15 years. But I think that's changing, and we're seeing an increasingly greater rate of churn and an acceptance by end users that applying patches and updates is acceptable behavior on a regular basis.
I would agree, and I think, for example, Chrome did a really good job in not giving users a choice. I know that was controversial at the time. Mm. But all of that is done on a service-to-service basis. Chrome decides to upgrade their web browser, and their web browser has, you know, the latest and greatest zero-day patches in it. But then there's some other app that you've downloaded that has some other vulnerability. And if you're a network administrator and you want to sort of double-check, you want to have the last say, the final authority on what's going on in your network. You don't want to go and just trust that every of the thousands of vendors who are providing software to your hundreds or thousands of users, you don't want to trust that all of those random people are doing their job right. You want to be the person who has the final say.
And to some ways, this is a philosophical argument.
It is a philosophical argument, yeah.
I don't want to spend too much time on this, but I did just want to sort of – I have always deployed middle boxes, proxy servers, IDS engines, tunneling firewalls, proxy firewalls of all sorts for enterprise DMZs for 15 years. And they are the only way to get a full inspection of the data. The other issue sort of as background to set up to talk about what you've done in your research is – we're also seeing increasing amounts of traffic. So the ever-increasing amounts puts greater and greater stress on middle boxes and how much packets they have to process and extract from the data, which makes it harder and harder to use middle boxes, of course.
Let me add another objection that's come from the networking community, because, you know, people have not liked middle boxes for a long time for a lot of reasons. And the networking community often thinks that they're sort of unpure, that – you know, we have this end-to-end argument that all of the smart functionality in networks happens at the edge of the network, at the end hosts, and that the network should be dumb, that that's the right way to design it. And it's the right way to design it because it leads to less flexibility for new protocols and new systems you want to design if the network makes assumptions about what's going on. And it's the right way to design it because you have performance overheads when you're inadvertently trying to optimize something that the end host doesn't want you to optimize for. But all of this has sort of, you know, there's been a lot of both academic and industrial discussion about whether or not middle boxes are the right way to do things. I think one of the big results that's come out of my research is that no matter what the argument is, the people who are opposed to middle boxes have kind of lost. And they've lost because middle boxes have taken over. About a third of networking infrastructure in enterprises and universities consists of middle boxes. All of the ISPs use them. And there seems to be no sign of them going away. NFV is this big, huge cross-industry agenda about making middle boxes better, not about getting rid of them. So, you know, while it's fun to sit around and argue about where they're coming from,
I'll argue about that. I think NFV. Right. There's two types of NFV here, right?
Okay.
There's one market for NFV, which is middle boxes, IDS, proxy servers, malware scanning, threat detection, load balances, blah blah blah, right? All of those intercept the traffic flow and munge it, and they have to steal the data to do something with it. They have to inspect the data to see something about it. There's also a part of NFV which says, instead of having hardware things like routers and hardware load balancers and hardware things, why don't I just have software versions of those? If I'm going to have Radius servers to authenticate people's handsets to the network, why don't I put the Radius servers in the bottom of the tower in a virtual machine? There are NFV instances which are middle boxes, and there is another branch of NFV which is about replacing hardware functions in the network with software functions.
But many of those hardware functions exist to provide middle box functionality. So it is all about hardware to software, but it's for a class of applications, most of which are middle boxes.
I don't see it that way. The biggest push around NFV for me today is to take the functions that are contained on my 3GPP. So in a 3G platform, there's like typically for every group of mobile base stations, there's 20 physical servers needed to handle authentication, monitoring and stuff like that. If I have a base station which is right next to a sports ball park, right, where grown men chase after bits of pigskin, you can have this situation where a lot of people come along and get excited about that.
Right.
And now all of a sudden my
mobile... You want to scale on demand.
The only way I can do that is if I have software instances. And maybe what I do is start saying, well, I'm going to move all of these instances that do malware scanning over to adjacent nodes, but I'm going to beef up the power that's available to the authentication node because I'm suddenly going to have 50,000 people who need to do authentication. Every time they hit the mobile tower node, authentication needs to happen. That's a branch
of... So why doesn't that authentication count as a middle box to you, given that it's an intermediary for your network access rather than...
It's not an intermediary, it's an endpoint. So the authentication is I log in, I do an authentication, it consults the database, approves it, finished. It doesn't transparently flood the data through it.
It does not transparently flood the data through it. There are also a set of middle boxes which don't sit in path. They sit off path and monitor data post facto. Would you call those middle boxes or would you call them something else?
If it's a monitoring only node, so if you're talking about what, packet capture?
Packet IDS, capture IPS? Offline, not so IDS rather than IPS.
Yeah, no, I don't see those as middle boxes. They're not in the middle of the flow.
I see.
They're monitoring boxes or...
Let's broadly call them network appliances then.
Okay.
Then, so all of these things that are about monitoring traffic in line, monitoring traffic offline, performing access control to or from the network, things that are not routers or switches, those are what NFV is all about. And some fraction of it is stuff that's sitting in the middle. But a lot of the challenges about managing and designing NFV, a lot of the challenges about privacy, it's sort of a fuzzy space about what is or isn't a middle box. Usually I think of them as anything that's in the network that's not the router or the switch.
A lot of the time they're in they're routers too.
They're routers, but sort of logically it's a separate bit of activity.
Well, increasingly there's a movement towards making, instead of having routers, PE, CE, MPLS routers, instead of having the CE router as a physical router on the customer's site, why not just put it as an NFV instance in the exchange? Because really there's only one route out from the customer's network. Why actually am I putting a router at the other end of it?
So it's a software router
at the end of a DWDM line or some sort of, you know, gigabit Ethernet line, and just do software routing, and you're not going to have many small... That's another possible use case there.
So actually, let's step back here because we're sort of kibitzing about over definitions here. But
we are,
I think one of the things that's really exciting is that networks aren't just forwarding stuff anymore. The fact that there is authentication that's going on that has something other to do with I just randomly connected my box to the network and DHCP told me that I had an IP address is something interesting and fun to think about, that it's a lot more complicated than classic networking. The fact that we're doing monitoring in the middle of the network for good things, for intrusion detection, is fun and interesting to think about as a scientist. And the fact that we can do this offline analysis about what's going on after the fact is going to tell us how to build our networks better in the future. And so all of these classes of devices, whether you call them middle boxes or network appliances, are a fun area of networking that historically the networking community has kind of ignored because they've been so focused on plumbing, getting traffic from one place to the other. Mm-hmm. And that broadly is the set of things that I'm interested in. Depending upon how you define it, these may or may not be middle boxes, or they may be a wider range of devices. It's the stuff that's not about plumbing, though.
Okay, I get your point, right? And I can agree with it in principle. Let me try and summarize or read back what you just said, which is there's two camps of networking. The network should be dumb. The connection goes over the top. It's end-to-end. The network should just be about passing packets through at the lowest latency possible and with the lowest packet loss that's possible. And there's another camp.
Not that the internet actually achieves that.
No.
But let's go on.
Well, the thing is actually what I'm discovering is that the internet does it better than private MPLS does. So I don't recommend it to keep using private MPLS circuits because the internet is a better quality. Now, the other train of thought says that the network should be an active component. It should get in amongst the sessions and the flows and the packets and munge them to achieve levels of service or levels of quality or performance or to do inspection or value adding of some sort in the network. And those are the two extremes of those discussions.
And the bottom line, I think, today is that that second camp has won. Despite the protests of the first, despite how fun it is to sit around in a graduate networking class and talk about our principles as networking engineer, the second camp has won.
Let me change topics for a little bit. But before we do, let's have a quick ad from our sponsor, ThousandEyes.
As your network expands to include cloud services, ISPs, and third-party providers, your visibility diminishes. It's kind of hard to see what you don't own, and that becomes a big problem when you're running critical applications, websites, and services on outsourced infrastructure. Figuring out what's gone wrong and who's responsible can take hours and, in some cases, weeks. And what about planning ahead to avoid those issues in the first place? So that brings us to our sponsor today, ThousandEyes. ThousandEyes gives you visibility into every network your company relies on. Your corporate network, the internet, cloud service provider network, all from one place. ThousandEyes cloud agents are deployed in locations all across the globe, and enterprise agents provide additional visibility from within your own network. Together, these vantage points provide the most complete understanding of network topology, dependencies, and behavior. Again, the networks you own and the networks that you don't. So let's consider this. How does all of this data from ThousandEyes help you out? And there's really three things you should consider. One, you can piece together multiple layers of network insight, from BGP routing and DNS to web server and layer 3 performance. In other words, you can tell what's going on in the internet BGP routing tables and how DNS is resolving, etc., and pull all that information together. Two, you can quickly and precisely pinpoint the root cause of problems, device faults, congestion, DDoS attacks, hijacks, route leaks, DNS failures, service provider outages. In other words, whatever's really going on, you can get right to the source of the problem with ThousandEyes. Three, you can take that data that you've found, those insights that you've gathered from the ThousandEyes interface, and then you can share it with vendors, with your customers. The big idea here is you can resolve your problems faster because you can say, hey, look what I found. So do you like what you hear? Good. Even better, there is a special offer just for Packet Pushers listeners. Sign up for a free account at www.thousandeyes.com/packetpushers, and you can choose a free ThousandEyes t-shirt. Start seeing your network like you've never seen it before. ThousandEyes, network intelligence you can see.
Let me divert for a little bit and talk about name data networking because I actually am in the first camp. So my firm belief is that in the public space, the network will always be dumb and passive. Mm. It's when operating at scale, it's simply not practical to do active network interception of any sort. In a private or at the edge of the network, you can certainly do middle boxes, but it would have to be under control of a smaller scaled operation like an enterprise or a managed service provider. Because the operation of these boxes is complicated enough, you can't do them at scale. You have to do them.
I agree 100%. We see middle box functionality. We see this advanced packet processing at the edge. We don't see it in the core. We don't see it on core routers going across the internet, and it's simply because there's just too much there.
Name data networking is about an active network model, about using the network, recognizing that the network is full of middle boxes like content delivery network providers and so forth, and that we don't need IP addresses going forward, or we should reduce our reliance on IP addresses and move it to names. Is that a fair statement? Are you familiar with NDN?
I'm familiar with NDN. It's not really where I think things are heading. It's certainly not something that is any part of my research. one of the things that middle boxes are so good at is that they try to be transparent. They don't try and change what end hosts do or don't expect the network to do. Mm-hmm. And that's part of their success. If we really required end-to-end upgrades for everything, we wanted to change naming, it would be much harder to deploy new solutions. And middle boxes have taken off because they drop in and are standalone upgrades without requiring the upgrades or even the consent of the end hosts who are being impacted.
And I think the point is the consent might be my particular bug bore, which
right.
hits one of my personal buttons. But that's enough.
So let's talk about TLS. You know, TLS and SSL are a huge challenge for middle boxes right now because they encrypt the data, and now you have basically one of two choices. You can either not decrypt the data, and you, as an administrator, have none of the benefits that you wanted, or you conversely, you can say that the client isn't receiving any of the benefits that you wanted to give them, or you can decrypt it, which violates the end-to-end privacy guarantees that users expect, potentially exposes an end host to things like TLS and SSL downgrades if the administrator doesn't quite know what they're doing, and can potentially also expose the end host to vulnerabilities if the middle box is able to be hacked, which is more and more a concern given that many of these are just Linux boxes running some special packet processing software.
Yeah, so TLS is going to be the long term. You know, the days of IPsec are probably fading away, although the recent TLS vulnerabilities might have slowed that down a little bit. And, of course, we've got the key management problems around TLS, which is an issue.
Right.
But if I have a middle box, like, say, a proxy server, and I want to cache all the content that people are using to hit a website, what I want to be able to do is to still, even in an encrypted session, break it open. Now, we're not in that position, are we?
No. Well, if you're in an enterprise, you push out certificates to everyone, you man in the middle everything, and you decrypt it. I know that Bluecoach sells boxes that are strictly for decryption and will just spit out a packet stream, and that's all the box does, and then you can plug and play whatever other functionality that you want. But in the sort of larger world, for the most part, no expectation of privacy, but in the larger world, that's not the greatest model. Mm. And one of the things that I think is interesting is that sometimes there are scenarios where users may want to allow some packet processing, but they're not quite sure about to what extent they should trust whoever's in the network. Mm. Let me give you a specific example. A friend of mine went and visited a neighboring university to give an academic talk. And they said, we have strict security policies on this university, and in order to use our network, you have to install our certificate so that we can monitor your traffic for whether or not you are hosting pirated content, you're running a botnet, you're doing something malicious from within our network. And he said, well, hell no, I don't want you to have the ability to read my emails or my messages and whatnot. And so here you had two fairly reasonable requests. You had a network administrator saying, you are a strange end host who has brought a strange laptop running software I don't control into my network, and I have a reasonable request that you not run malicious content on my network. Mm. And my friend had a very reasonable request that he didn't want to hand over the keys to the kingdom. He didn't want to give them access to everything that he was going to send out over the network. And the problem with TLS right now is that you either get one thing or the other. You either get all of the packet processing benefits and there's no privacy, or you get no benefits from the packet processing and great privacy. And, you know, in databases and operating systems, they talk a lot about the principle of least privilege, which is this idea that if you're going to give someone access to your data or your system, you should give them an account or some sort of view of the data with restricted visibility and restricted capabilities that's limited to specifically the behavior that they need to do in order to perform the task you want to do. Mm. TLS and SSL don't give you that. They have no principle of least privilege. You either get 100% access to all of the data in the flow, or you get nothing.
Well, and not only that, once you've given away your key in your browser and you're fail-forwarding your data to the proxy server, whether explicitly or transparently, you get everything. Banking, email, web browsing, you know, everything goes through the proxy server. You can't sit there and say, I'm happy for you to look at traffic just for malware, but they're going to have to inspect everything to know what's got malware in it.
Right.
And that includes, they can get your banking credentials, how much money's in your bank account, you know, everything.
Everything. So this is an active area of research right now, and I think how you probably stumbled on my page, somebody linked to it in a recent podcast you did. And so there are three sort of pushes of research right now for how we could maybe get a reasonable middle ground. And the first push is protocol-based. There's a project called MCTLS that comes out of Carnegie Mellon University. And the idea here is that within a given session, you actually use multiple keys. So my web browser should somehow be aware of the fact that pieces of content in the page have more restrictive levels of security than other pieces of content in the page. So I might encrypt the password that I'm sending with one key, and I might encrypt the page content, the images, the text with another key. And I might encrypt the URL field in the HTTP header with an entirely different key. What does this allow me to do? Well, if there is a middle box on the path that says, well, I'm running a parental filter, this is a school, but really I only need access to the URL you're trying to connect to, then you can give them the key that belongs to the URL without giving access to the page contents or the password. Or if I'm at this university that my friend was at, he could give them the key both for the URL and the page contents, but not the key for the password. And so you could give them partial access to the data, restricted just to that particular flow.
Okay, so that's narrowing down what the permissions you're giving away in that sense.
Right, right. The second push of research in that, and that's the area I've worked on, is using cryptographic guarantees. So I'll talk about, we have two systems in this space, one called Blindbox and another one called Embark. Embark is actually being presented today at Network Systems Design and Implementation, which is a Usenix conference being held in California. And the idea behind Blindbox and Embark, they're quite related, is that you can use functional cryptography to restrict the behavior of the middle box. And with Blindbox, you use a technique called searchable encryption. So the idea here is that, you know, Symantec, McAfee, Emerging Threats, these are the companies that go out and generate rule sets of what is or isn't malicious behavior on the internet. Mm-hmm. And they can sign that, they can give it a cryptographic signature to their rule set and distribute that to all of the middle boxes. And if I connect to a random cafe, I can send my data encrypted using searchable encryption over the network. And this searchable encryption has the property that a middle box is allowed to search through the encrypted data without decrypting it. And they will have the ability to discover if one of these rules that Symantec or McAfee, some company that I trust, has signed. If one of those rules is present, the middle box will learn that that word was present and nothing more. Mm-hmm. But if the rule is not present, they learn nothing. The data remains encrypted. Unfortunately, the problem with this space is that it's functional cryptography, which tends to have fairly high overheads. Mm-hmm. So as of yet, it's not practical, but it seems like another useful middle ground.
And so the anti-case that immediately came to mind is that companies like Symantec and McAfee and Avast have actually not shown astonishing competency in software development to be able to do this reliably and trustworthy. So, for example, in the last 3 months, all of them have been shown to be vulnerable to sandbox bypasses inside their own engines.
That's true. That's true. So whatever your trusted third party is, be it, it sure better be someone that you trust. Yeah. What's nice here is that the trust is tied to the rule set, not to the software. The cryptography that you use has an end-to-end guarantee that no matter what software is running in the middle box, the only thing that they're able to do is detect whether or not these encrypted terms are or aren't present. Now you're only trusting them with the ability to generate useful rule sets.
But that's fairly simplistic. You're looking at heuristics or pattern matching.
That's true. That's right. True. So, right. So you can't run scripts with this. You can't. You can run some regular expressions if you can convert them to pattern matching, but you can't run all of them.
And you also can't be adaptive. So it's very much I'm looking for this pattern in the crypto stream. If I detect this, then something's wrong.
Right. If I detect this, I might be able to go back and request a new rule, but that would take time.
And it would also assume that you could then halt the packet flow until the new rule could be established.
Yeah.
And so then you've got interception. Sorry, not interception, but you're impacting the flow until the rule can be located, found, and loaded. Yes.
Right. And fully homomorphic encryption or full functional encryption functional cryptography would give you a lot more flexibility in what your capabilities are. Mm-hmm. But at that point, the performance overheads, you start to get to talking about, well, processing one packet would take 100 years. And the thing about Blindbox and Embark is that they have restricted capabilities, but they do run at reasonable line rates. Blindbox can forward traffic at about, I think, 180 megabits per second, which isn't amazing compared to non-encrypted things, but it's starting to get into the realm of something that you could actually use with, you know, a little bit more hammering on it.
Hi, everybody. This is Drew Conry-Murray from Packet Pushers, jumping in to tell you about Telari, a sponsor for today's show. Here on Packet Pushers, we've talked about the evolving and sometimes confusing SD-WAN market. Telari's here to bring clarification. Telari's been making WANs better for 8 years now, creating a thinking SD-WAN that makes the network smart and responsive, adapting in real time to changing conditions. What's Telari's secret sauce? Telari's patented approach puts intelligence in every packet and at every endpoint, performing true one-way measurement of every data packet coming and going. They identify packet loss, jitter, and the failure of any one network path, and then they use all the network's capacity to reroute packets and keep your data flowing no matter what. With Telari, mission-critical apps like VoiceOver IP and VDI take priority and always deliver. Your less time-sensitive traffic like file backups fall in line. Do you want to know more about how Telari's thinking SD-WAN turns your bandwidth into brainwidth, upticks your uptime, and frees up your own time to be brilliant? Visit them at telari.com and listen to the Packet Pushers conversation with John Dickey, Telari's co-founder and CTO. Telari is the proven SD-WAN solution that started in the SD-WAN space before it was even labeled as such. Check them out at telari.com. And now, back to Ethan and Greg.
So let me ask this. If I had the idea of doing pattern matching, as you say, homomorphic encryption, that is that I can do it in a single instance or on a single flow.
Right.
In and of itself, endpoint encryption isn't very endpoint malware detection or endpoint virus scanning isn't very useful. Mm-hmm. But what we've been able to do is to engage it with a cloud function. That is, the signatures are constantly updated every 30 minutes, 60 minutes, and the cloud function has machine learning or analytic capability to detect reports coming in from millions of possible sources and rapidly identify new threats and then push them out. And in that
case, could imagine the middle box pulling in new rules constantly from this provider as well. Let me talk about the third branch, which there's not been a lot of work in this space just yet, but I think we're moving in this direction, which is that researchers are increasingly looking at Intel's SGX to implement middle boxes. Mm-hmm. So I would trust Intel's certificate. And Intel certificate would basically show me that this is signed middle box searching code for specific rules, similar to Blindbox and Embark, that these are rules that have been signed by someone I trust. And the middle box can scan through my traffic, decrypting it, doing arbitrary computation, using this trusted software or these trusted rules. And then by the time it actually leaves the processor again, it's now encrypted again. So anyone who has physical access to the box does not have access to the raw data. Now, this is the software vulnerability problem that you just talked about.
Yeah.
But
escaping
it's much
from
more,
where you can escape from a protected enclave.
But it's much more flexible than the cryptographic model. So what you're trading off is this end-to-end guarantee that the cryptography is implemented by the end hosts, and therefore, bad code is going to have no impact. Bad code in the network is going to have no impact on your security. And here you're trusting that Intel has signed the software and run it correctly, but now you can do a lot more. You can do whatever that software is allowing you to run. And I think there's probably going to be some research coming out on that front in the near future.
Software Guard Extensions is, I'm just searching for it as I'm talking to you.
Ah, yeah. So the idea here is that everything in memory is encrypted. The processor decrypts data before it operates on it. And then as soon as it wants to put anything back into cache or into memory, it re-encrypts it. So even if somebody has physical access to the box and does any of these crazy hacker things where they're using microscopes or scanners or they're freezing the device, all of that doesn't work because the data as it's stored in the system is encrypted.
It leaves the CPU, I imagine.
Yeah, and so the only time that it's encrypted or decrypted is literally while it's inside the CPU. Mm-hmm. And so you'd have to crack open the CPU while it's processing data in order to figure out what the value of even a single register is.
So this then prevents things like the Rowhammer attack where you hit the memory with adjacent LAN, you can start to, from the errors that it creates, start to see what the memory is in adjacent rows.
I don't know about that particular attack. Mm-hmm. But it prevents a wide class of attacks.
So that's a feature unique to Intel's x86 platform. It's a hardware and software function, I expect.
It's a hardware function. The software, I think, is not – the only people I know who have these boxes are currently in the research community. And I know that the software is not particularly mature yet. So the hardware function is out there. People have the hardware. But developing the software, both developing applications that use this hardware and developing the interfaces that sit between the hardware and the software layer are sort of actively being worked on. And so you might want to go back and compare this to TPMs. But
that was my next question. Yeah. You picked it out of my mind, I'm sure of it.
This is starting to push out of my area of expertise. But what my understanding is, and this is what I've been told by computer architects, is that breaking into that processor while it's running, A, is harder. It's just, I'm not quite sure why, but A, it's harder. But B, whatever you get in there is going to be the value of the registers in that processor at that moment. And once you've broken into it, presumably it's not running anymore. With a TPM, they had these attacks where you could unglue it, get this sort of global key. Once you know what that key is, you could manipulate whatever the software was running on the device. And so all you had to do was break open the box once and sort of game over. Whereas in once you get into the processor, even if you do manage to get in the processor, there's less information that you would be able to access. And you would have basically broken the system's ability to process any more data after that.
So it's the sort of thing that'll appear in enterprise products down the line.
So this is a long time away.
2 to 5 years.
Yeah.
Maybe longer. It did take Intel a long time to get DVDK off the ground.
DVDK is so lovely, though. I'm glad we have it now.
You are? So you've written code in DVDK?
Oh, yes. Everything we build for our experiments is based on DVDK-based middle boxes.
I'm looking at your research paper from 2012 where you did a survey of enterprise middle box deployments.
Yes.
Lots of really interesting data in there.
Right.
Sort of thing. Do you want to sort of pick out any highlights from that research?
Highlights? I think the most surprising thing were the sheer numbers. In at least the academic community, there had been this perception that middle boxes were rare, they were edge cases, they were these funny little devices that, you know, we should kind of ignore because they just weren't all that common. And what we found was that they were about a third of enterprise infrastructure. And so
you could have just asked me, I would have told you the same thing.
Well, I had to ask a lot of people, right?
Yes, because that's right.
Because if you ask just one guy, it's like, well, that's your network. And so I actually went out and talked to 60 people that I met on the NANOG mailing list. It was surprising how consistent their answers were. They tended to all replace the devices about every 3 to 5 years. They all said that not all, but the vast, vast majority said that misconfiguration was their most common cause of failure. So this was a huge cause of errors. A lot of people spent a lot of time dealing with errors. That they were expensive, hard to manage.
The thing I've been saying on the packet pushers for the last 5 years is in a modern enterprise, less than 20% of my time is spent doing networking and 80% of my time is spent futzing with middle boxes.
So right.
The DMZ, the WAN optimizers, the VPN concentrators, the load balancers, very, very few people actually spend their time configuring routing protocols.
Yeah, no, you're actually dealing with all of the errors that come from all of these devices.
It's more the churn. These things need constant attention. So the protocols are changing, so a proxy server needs to be constantly updated or the WAN optimizer needs to be constantly reconfigured as, you know, we shift from SMB1 to SMB2 to SIFS 3.0.
So the other thing that I think is unsurprising once you think about it is not just the upgrade rate in the middle boxes themselves, but the fact that they're all different. So, you know, if I buy 10 routers and they're all from the same manufacturer and they're all the same make, I know how to configure that. If I buy 10 middle boxes and one of them's an IDS and the other one's a WAN optimizer and the other one's a proxy, that's three different user interfaces that I have to learn, three different configuration policies, three different sets of skills that I need to understand. And so it's no surprise that it's so easy to get things wrong in this space or it's so easy for things to quickly go awry. It's just, there's a lot more to think about when you're dealing with general purpose compute than when you're dealing with routing and switching.
And my personal experience matches that. And perhaps the thing which leads me into my next or segues into my next point, which is operational administration. The single biggest challenge I have with middle boxes, aside from the fact that they break flows and therefore as protocols evolve, they have to be continually monitored and changed. So as we move from, say, TLS 1.2 to TLS 1.3, I hope that's correct. My mind's a bit vague today. I'm a bit tired. You know, and as TLS changes and then crypto changes and then later on, you know, people are starting to talk about, instead of using browser-based cryptography CA stores, I'll start to use DNSSEC. Well, those middle boxes have to continuously evolve
upgrade.
All the time.
Yeah.
Right? Upgrade, be changed. You can't just sit still. You can't ignore a WAN optimizer when all of a sudden the protocol is changing across it, keep iterating.
And something – the transparency of the middle boxes is the thing that makes them great and easy to deploy. If you have figured out a good set of expectation of what all possible protocols that your end host could be using, then you're good to go. You can drop it in without having upgrade.
That's a deeply unrealistic if.
That things go wrong all the time. Hmm. One of my favorite research papers of all time is this paper called Is It Still Possible to Extend TCP? And it was written by the multipath TCP guys before they deployed multipath TCP. And here's the problem. They were trying to build multipath TCP, and they had all of these lovely experiments that they ran in their lab. Everywhere they tried to deploy it in the real world, middle boxes just threw up their hands and said, this is garbage. I can't handle this. And, you know, it's pretty easy to think about it. Like, if you had a naive approach to multipath TCP, I might have one TCP stream and half the sequence numbers go down one path and half the sequence numbers go down another path. Mm. And then you have middle boxes who are trying to reconstruct the TCP stream saying, I'm missing half the data. And that makes the middle box go, something's wrong here. I should block this connection. It's pretty bad. And so they actually, in order to design multipath TCP, had to go out and basically measure what middle boxes expected. And then from the edge, had to design a protocol that middle boxes were going to be happy with, which is not what anyone ever wanted to be happening from the beginning. From the get-go, we thought that middle boxes should just be compatible with everything and no one would ever notice that they were there. But the minute you try to innovate or design something new, the middle boxes just throw up their hands and get angry.
I've heard this discussion many, many times. And in fact, David Meyer gave a presentation on that at Brocade about 2 years ago, and he was using – well, David Meyer, not, in addition to being a computer scientist, is also a biology scientist. And he was saying that the TCP/IP model follows the biological system in that at every point in any biological system, there's something in the middle of it called the waste. I can't remember the exact terminology.
This is a Georgia Tech thing. The idea here comes from Constantine Davralis. And so there's this paper called the guy behind that idea is Constantine Davralis. He's at Georgia Tech. It's actually a pretty controversial conjecture. I think it's a really interesting space of work.
It certainly resonates with me, and everybody I've spoken to who's a practitioner said actually mirrors their experience. You can't change TCP/IP because invariably you can't change the edge and the core at the same time. Any modifications to the TCP/IP protocol requires you to change every router in the network. That's why IPv6 isn't being implemented.
IPv6 is taking off. The numbers. It is. Recently. Okay.
Yeah. It's all it's at 5%. Google's numbers at 10% are inflated. Like Jeff Houston released some research recently saying that Google's 10% is probably inflated
Yahoo's
by about 100.
Yahoo's numbers are in the upper teens. You don't believe it?
No.
All right.
If you want to talk about it in terms of what's happening in China or in the Asia-Pacific region, where it's probably up towards 15 to 20%, sure. Uh-huh. And on the internet is going to be very different from what's happening inside, say, enterprise networks.
We totally should not be talking about IPv6 right now because it's a middle box session.
Yes.
But I definitely want to connect you to my friend Stephen Schroes. He's the IPv6 evangelist for Yahoo. And I had your reaction and he convinced me otherwise, but I will let him make his own arguments.
We are building up momentum behind it. That is, a lot of the endpoints like smartphones and desktops are actually becoming IPv6 ready. But right now, and Jeff Houston on a recent show on the future of networking, he talked extensively. He said the point is that the 48-bit TCP IPv4 address space with 32s, and then if you take the TCP port numbers, actually gives us a 48-bit addressing scheme, which might be good enough for us to get by for another 5 to 10 years. In other words, NAT boxes, you know, carrier-grade NAT.
Yes. I'm not going to have this argument on this show, but I am going to send Stephen to you because Stephen definitely convinced me otherwise. And 5 to 10 years is not the kind of internet that we should be thinking about. We should be thinking about the internet for the future, which we can go back to middle boxes and whether or not middle boxes are the internet for the future.
Well,
I'm happy to have that discussion.
Sorry, I tend to get it. I'm very spread across all of the networking, so it's not.
Yeah. No. I also have had many fun IPv6 debates in my research career.
Yes, I think eventually IPv6 will get there, but not because anybody wants it, but because life is miserable and sad, and we have to put IPv6 in because we have to.
I would agree with that.
Not because we want to. It doesn't offer it.
I don't think anybody particularly loves IPv6, but I think that we're finally starting to see a turning point. But maybe we have or have not seen the turning point. But I think we will eventually get there.
But again, it's going to be, you know, are the middle boxes able to cope with it as much as are the routers and firewalls all through the network? And part of the reason that IPv6 deployments are slow is because of middle boxes who don't understand it.
Right. So I have a student who used to work with me who now works on porting middle boxes to IPv6 all day. That's his job. I don't envy him. It seems very difficult. And you have to sit down in the nitty-gritty of all the details of all the protocols. Mm. One of the things we sort of lack, when we were looking at the ACID tests for web browsers and, you know, was this browser compatible with the new version of JavaScript, the new version of CSS, yada, yada. Mm. We had this lovely test suite that would tell us whether or not the software we were building was compatible with where the standards were heading. We have no equivalent for middle boxes. We have no test suite that says, here are all the protocols we're using. We'd like to implement this new protocol. Please send this out to all the vendors. Are they aware of this new protocol? Are they compatible with these changes? We don't do that. And the browser community has had a huge difficulty with evolution, but they've actually done a better job than we have. And that's probably pretty sad, but I think we can take a lesson there from the ACID tests and try to design some sort of suite of expectations of protocols that a middle box should be aware of.
The whole idea of automated testing of infrastructure is still not done, and I don't understand why not. Why do we not have a set of standard tests for validating OSPF or you know, anything in networking? As a customer, I should be able to go and run a test against my vendor's router to validate that OSPF features are as they are.
Are they implemented correctly? Yeah.
Yes, because the vendors clearly can't do that.
Right? Well, and you
because
would like
experience
to be able to.
Suggests that they're clearly not doing it because they ship products that just don't do things like redistribute routes from OSPF to BGP correctly or time after time after time. And that is a whole area I'd love to see.
You'd like to be able to do a cross-industry comparison as well. Like I remember, you know, IPv6, you would pull up the ACID test page and it would just come out bonkers, and you would pull it up on Firefox and it would look nice. And it would be like, which browser am I going to use? Well, I'm going to use the Firefox browser. Yeah. And if I could do that for my networking devices, then I think we would have a path forward to talk about protocol evolution and middle boxes. We would have a mechanism to say, here are the tests that you have to be compatible with in order to deploy the latest device.
But that's the weakness in middle boxes, is every time something's changed, is the middle boxes have to iterate as well.
It's true. It's true. But they have to iterate alongside the end hosts.
So it's not just the middle boxes, it's the end hosts. And in the case of IPv6, so does every router in the network.
Yes, in the case of IPv6, so does every router in the network.
But, and firewall and, you know, whatever it is.
But that's why IPv6 is fundamentally harder to deploy than the features that middle boxes deploy, right? If you look at, if you were to go back N years and say, what are the new things I want in my network? Well, I want DDoS defense, or I want a larger address space. Mm. It turned out that a larger address space was fundamentally harder to build into the network because you had to change everything. Whereas we have some kind of okay approaches to DDoS defense that rely on deflecting traffic around and placing middle boxes in the middle to cut down on aggregates coming into a single site.
Yes, that's an application of it. Of middle boxes that is hard to see replaced.
It's also an application that's easier to deploy than larger addresses. That's what middle boxes are good at, right? Middle boxes are good at things that you can drop in the middle. New addresses, it's too hard because it requires end-to-end updates.
Middle boxes for me work best when I turn them on, and more importantly, when I can turn them off. for the reasons I've explained, that is, you know, if I put them in the critical path between two points, then everything becomes dependent upon the middle box. And the weakest, the most complex part, what is it, Occam's razor, the most obvious thing is the thing?
Yeah.
So it's always the middle box which is broken. But more importantly is the middle boxes don't have the instrumentation to say, I'm not broken. So yeah. They always become the point of blame. So as somebody who ran the proxy server for very large financial institutions, every time something stopped working, guess who got the blame the first time?
Yeah, it was you.
It was me. And there was no way for me to say, oh, the box is working perfectly because it had such poor instrumentation. Do you think there's some way we can answer that? Is it possible to instrument these middle boxes and into some sort of self-testing, I'm working, I'm updated,
I want this acid test thing. I want, you know, I plug in a box on all of the ports and I send traffic in and out and I have some model for what it means for the middle box to be compatible with all these different protocols. I run everything through and I see that it's doing what it's supposed to correctly. And we don't have that right now. And I think the very task of documenting the behavior of all of these different protocols is a difficult one. Even getting compatibility between two different instantiations of, I don't know, say SSL is like part of the protocol evolution process. And it's something that's difficult. You have to design tests to compare two different instantiations of TLS. You have to design tests to compare whether or not your new version of TCP is compatible with the old versions of TCP. Mm-hmm. And to throw middle boxes in there is just sort of yet another thing to throw in. But it's what you have to do if you want protocols to evolve. This is one of the things that makes networking fundamentally more difficult than other areas of computer science, that everybody has to agree on how things work and what is or isn't correct behavior. You're writing your own software in your own little bubble. You're safe.
That's the nature of networking. Everybody has to be working from the same premise.
Yeah.
Whereas in computer science, you want to build a new computer language? Knock off you go. Build Go.
It's all yours.
Yeah, it's just your program that needs to run Go. You don't have all of a sudden have to stop. You don't have to convince everybody else to stop using Python, Perl, you know, JavaScript, Java, blah, blah, blah. You just make it and off you go. Same with databases for that matter.
You touched on something with IPv6 that I really want to hit home again, which is that, you know, for a long time we talked about all of the things that were wrong with the internet that we couldn't solve, that were hard to deploy new capabilities. Addressing was one of them, and it turns out that addressing is fundamentally hard because you have to upgrade everything. But middle boxes are often an easy way to add new features, and that's the way that we allow our networks to evolve and have new capabilities. And that's nice because who wants to work in a field where somebody designed all the protocols 30 years ago and we just kept using the same stuff?
Well, I think this is where we get into a discussion around overlays, where I actually don't want to run – I think I've gotten to the point where I fundamentally believe that service providers – are a bunch of incompetent monkeys. Really. And the best that I can hope for is that they are actually capable of making an IP packet go between two points in a graph.
I hope so.
And if I'm going to do some make turn that bandwidth into a service, then I have to do something at the edge. Because I do not fundamentally have any belief that service providers, and partly they're to blame because of their business models, their high profit margin, their shareholders are expecting, and they're being commoditized, and they're built on lots of legacy technologies, which is hard to change because they have, you know, when you've got 10,000, 20,000, 50,000 routers that have to be replaced, and you have to send a truck roll to every site to do that. And, you know, that's an expensive undertaking, especially when changing those things delivered zero financial result to your bottom line.
What do you think about AT&T Domain 2.0?
I think it's nice, but I do question whether it will actually get off the ground. So AT&T is large. It's an enormous business. There might be a business unit, and I'm not close enough to Domain 2.0 to have any specifics here, but
yesterday that they – I don't know if they announced this or just implied this, that they were going to open source their management framework. I think it's called eComp or something similarly not sexy. But I've never heard AT&T talk about open sourcing things, so it got me a little happy.
No, I read an article recently about open source and why you want to do that. And, you know, the reasons for open sourcing are, A, you want to build people. If you could get other people using that software, it's much easier to recruit people to run that software and develop for it, right? If you accept that you are in a commodity industry, everybody running the same software makes sense. Right? Secondly, if you can get other people developing software for your company, that's free development.
Right.
Even if it comes from your competitors, it's still free development. And again, if you're in a commoditized industry where everybody's just pumping out bandwidth at scale, that makes good sense. And secondly, getting out there and making it open source and publishing it gives you free press, free marketing. Now, the question is, how deep does Domain 2.0 go? There are still very large parts and business units inside of AT&T that are still buying the same old stuff from the same old vendors that they've been doing for the last 40 years.
Right.
And they have zero intention of changing that. Domain 2.0 is an initiative at best that may or may not get sufficient traction that AT&T might actually buy it. It could actually be just a purchasing strategy. That is, literally, we need our vendors to reduce their prices by this much. They are never going to do it because they know they've got us over a barrel. If I could do this, this might just be a purchasing initiative. Say, you know what, we could just go and use Whitebox and do all of this stuff unless you drop your prices by 40%.
That's very saddening to me. I really hope it takes off.
That's the world I live in.
I know. I'm also skeptical, but I refuse to be cynical.
Follow the money. It's always about the money. The technology initiates a decision. Technology can motivate a change, but money will either put the fuel in the engine for it or kill it completely. I think it could go either way at the end of the day. The simple point is that bandwidth is being commoditized. That is, it's about producing it in bulk and such vast quantities that you can reduce the cost per meg down. And the concept that you can extract services from bandwidth then, if it becomes a volume gain, the concept that you can extract services from it by value adding to it becomes less and less possible because you have to operate
it's
at such
volume. Yeah.
Because you're operating at such scale. Right. So if we start to get to gigabit to the home bandwidth, how are you going to cache that? The best you can do is start putting CDNs from the major CDN providers inside your network to reduce the interconnect bandwidth. And that would be far more viable than getting into the middle via a middle box to intercept every traffic and then dynamically, right? Because then you've got to administrate the middle box. Now you've got a team of 30, 50, 100 people running middle boxes.
I've just been a little bit confused about it. Somebody's made this argument to me before that we're not even going to scale. So, okay, there's the argument about whether or not you put advanced processing in the core of the network. And I think everybody agrees that's a bad idea. There's just too much going on there. Mm. But then there's the argument about whether or not advanced processing is going to continue to scale at the edge of the network. And in my mind, that everything that's going on at the edge of the network is essentially bounded by the amount of compute infrastructure that exists in a home or an enterprise. Mm. And hence, it can't scale beyond what a middle box cluster of middle boxes could process, because the data is always proportional to what some number of devices at the edge of the network is producing or consuming. It doesn't make sense to me that, you know, a home or an enterprise is going to produce or consume so much data that a proportional amount of infrastructure in the middle of the network can't keep up with it.
So I can give you my input to that if you're interested.
Yeah.
I believe that we're sort of at the point now where we're generating basically as much traffic as humans can create. Mm. So that is there's only so much Netflix you can watch. There's only so much, you know, the Netflix is 30% of the internet at different times of the day, you know.
Right.
Go and look at Cisco's visual network index and you can get lots and lots of scary, scary numbers. But fundamentally, we're reaching the point where even in China and Africa, where there's still lots of growth in the established, where communications are established, say in EMEA and Americas, for example, the growth of bandwidth per user is largely static. We can't get much more email or much more Facebook or much more Netflix or streaming video or telephone calls. We just don't need more bandwidth. Once you get to 20 megs or 30 megs a person, that's all you need. The demand flattens off. So what the vendors are betting on is IoT. And the unique thing about IoT is you're now starting to talk about machine-to-machine communications. So take, for example, Amazon Echo. Amazon Echo, new endpoint, talking to servers in Amazon clouds. Amazon Echo will become the center potentially of an ecosystem, which is locks, air conditioners, temperature sensors, refrigerator monitoring. So now all of a sudden you might have 30 devices in your home for two people. And those things will, how much bandwidth will they generate to access the services? Will it be local? That is, will it go through a hub? Or will each of those 30 devices be an incompatible standard communicating to an incompatible cloud? Or maybe there's compatibility in the cloud platform that communicates between them. If they go with the bandwidth issue, there's going to be a massive spike in bandwidth, particularly around baseline consumption, because those devices will communicate on regular intervals. Not necessarily every 60 seconds, every 60 minutes, but they'll wake up when they've got data to ship off to the central cloud. Companies out there who want to get in the middle of that, in the network, in the proxy, in the middle boxes in that environment are hugely problematic because those devices may never be updatable.
Keith Winstein at Stanford will tell you that IoT means that we have to have more middle boxes, because no one who's selling you a smart light bulb is going to give you any hooks into what that smart light bulb transmits about you to their provider, or not even a smart light bulb, let's say a baby monitor. Mm-hmm. And so if you're going to have any privacy knobs or hooks, the incentives are not aligned for the manufacturers to give you that on the IoT devices. And hence it has to be in the middle. I think the hard thing about this is that end-to-end encryption is something that the manufacturers could probably deploy against you and take that away from you.
Do client certificate validation in the cloud, and if it's intercepted, it just dies.
Right,
it just refuses
right.
to. Yeah. So the interception's never possible. Yeah.
But I think his argument is that there should be some sort of standard that allows you to monitor what's going on in the middle. I don't know whether or not that'll take off. It's certainly an interesting line of thought.
My initial reaction is, could middle boxes scale to the, you know, vast numbers of IoT devices that we're talking about? And will the vendors, as you say, let that happen if they're capturing value from the data that goes off? So the Amazon Echo value for Amazon is partly to do with Amazon.
Amazon has invested that much infrastructure in processing my data somewhere. So why shouldn't the middle box? The middle box can't be an order of magnitude more than the amount of infrastructure that's producing the data. Even if the infrastructure sits somewhere else, there's a fixed amount of infrastructure that's dedicated per person. And maybe it's going to increase, but you're not going to need two orders of magnitude more infrastructure in the network to monitor all that communication.
No, I definitely believe that.
Yeah.
Yes, you will need more infrastructure in the network because you're talking about cars, and in the car, every tire, the car, you know, every system in the car will be an IoT device of some sort.
Right.
And there'll be a network. There's already a car Ethernet standard.
Oh God, and it's so dangerous. I was just at UC San Diego where they did a lot of the early car hacking work, and it was just terrifying.
I seem to remember routers in 2001 being incredibly easy to crack open too. Mm. So I'm philosophical about that. I think that iteration will probably see that solve itself over time. And the press, our lovely ability in the technical community to gleefully, you know, make fun of vendors who do the obviously bad security thing.
Right, right.
I think there's an awareness that it needs to be solved up front. But, you know, not just cars, not just houses, but what about offices? So today the building management systems in an office are barely connected via modems. What if you've got thousands of sensors, light bulbs? Every light bulb is an active point. So Cisco has its digital lighting strategy where they're talking about connecting light bulbs to Ethernet switches, powering them from Ethernet switches.
Power over Ethernet, yeah.
So they can control the lights very, very simply. And they have partnerships with General Electric and with Philips in these initiatives, and Johnson Controls and other very, very large companies who can then put these devices on site, and Cisco will be in the middle of that stream. Middle boxes or SDN control, I think that's much more of an SDN control problem than it is going to be a middle box.
I think the fundamental problem with IoT is that the incentives are just wrong. These manufacturers do not want to give you access to the data.
This is like Verizon, right? Verizon's extracting $24 billion a year out of middle boxes in terms of data collection and selling it to data brokers in real time.
Well, and you've seen the Verizon super cookie stuff. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's out of the International Computer Science Institute in Berkeley.
That super cookie is worth $24 billion.
Yeah. It's terrifying. And so the incentives just aren't right. And I think the first pass of thought from the academic world was that we need some sort of open operating system or open communication standard. And there are people who are actively working at that. And then there are people who are cynical that anyone would actually adopt that open operating system or communication standard because it's not in their interest at the manufacturers. And so then there was yet another wave of people who said, well, why don't we intercept the communications in the middle box? But we know that end-to-end encryption is going to allow you to avoid that as well. Mm-hmm. So I think technically it's a little bit doom and gloom unless there's some sort of legislative process that says specifically, here is how you need to expose the information that you're recording about people from within your homes. I don't think that there's a technical way around this, given that we don't control the end infrastructure. I don't think middle boxes are going to save us, although maybe they could for a short while as until things are designed specifically to avoid middle boxes.
Okay, so we talked about blind box and MBOC.
Yep. Yep.
Which is your primary initiative, which is a way to use middle boxes to have partial inspection.
Right.
What about aplomb? Is that
A plum is so my dissertation is basically saying that middle boxes are actually too annoying to manage in typical companies. If someone wanted to provide them as a service, be that an ISP, a particularly enlightened and very technically advanced ISP, or more likely a cloud.
I'll take back what I said earlier about them being.
No, to be honest.
Go on.
We divined aplomb with cloud providers in mind because we were skeptical about whether or not ISPs would follow this model. Mm-hmm. And so what we showed in aplomb is that you can use overlay routing to route traffic through data centers. Mm-hmm. Overlay routing is known to have great performance properties. The overheads just aren't that bad. And it saves your average IT administrator, particularly at small companies where maybe you just don't want to deal with this stuff. It saves them from having to think about actually managing the physical hardware. Say, I want intrusion detection. Mm. I want you to download the latest policies. Here's how much traffic I have roughly on average. Just make it happen. Mm-hmm. All I'm going to be in charge of from my enterprise is managing one box that tunnels the traffic to or from the nearest data center. And someone at the data center is going to manage a service that does all the processing for me.
So virus scanning is a service in the network instead of doing it on the chassis or something like that.
Doing it in the network somewhere where, you know, it's not the local IT administrator who has to do it. It's all about making things cheaper and easier for the folks on the ground.
It's a managed service concept.
Yeah, it's managed services outside for the network. And the thing that was surprising about this is, you know, you'd seen it for mail, you'd seen it for storage, you'd seen it for compute, you'd seen it for everything. But the fact that we could actually do it for a large fraction of networking infrastructure was pretty cool.
So you're a fan of overlay networking? I still get into debates with people about whether overlay networking is viable and stuff. And some people point out that the lack of, in the internet in particular, you've still got so many boxes not implementing jumbo frames. So your encapsulation process can be a problem because you oversize the frames and then the internet won't forward them.
Well, you can encapsulate, cut them apart, and put them back together on the other side. That doesn't seem to be a problem, right? You just use TCP. Mm. But I think the benefit of the overlay networking here, you're not using overlay networking specifically for improved performance, although it does give you better latency. You're using it to get access to services. And the idea is that the services would be cheaper if someone was managing them in a data center than at the edge.
Yeah. Proxy service at scale is cheaper than managing them unit by unit.
Right. And the scaling benefits are all the same old things that we see for web servers, right? Web servers are more popular at some hours of the day than others, so you scale up, scale down. Networks have exactly the same properties. There was at least one enterprise we looked at that had a 13-time ratio between their peak bandwidth consumption and their average bandwidth consumption. So they were 13 times over-provisioned to handle the worst hours of the day. And this problem just goes away when you have a large provider who can amortize those costs and sell you 13 times as many boxes for 1 hour out of the day, and then the rest of the day you pay for less infrastructure.
That's also just bad operations too. Lack of instrumentation, lack of monitoring a lot of the time.
What do you mean?
It's like they talk about the public cloud being burstable, right? Because it has an infinite amount of capacity. They have so many unused machines, you can burst to any size that you want. But the flip side of that is that your average enterprise data center, only 5% or maybe as much as 20% is actually used.
Right.
Because the majority of it is locked up into little silos and you can't share storage, you can't share compute, can't whatever.
Right.
And the point perhaps is that for most people, if only they could build shared scale horizontal infrastructure instead of operating in silos and preventing horizontal working.
Right. If they had a lot of shared infrastructure that they could go up and down for at the peak hour of the day, this is a proxy. And then at the average hour of the day, this is just some, you know, background compute tasks that can be done whenever.
Yes. Or just clock back the operations of non-critical infrastructure so that the stuff that needs to burst is burst. There's lots of ways of doing it, but the problem is that a lot of these ISPs have their own functional, their internal problems that they can't actually break out of the silos to build these new methods.
Right. But the outsourcing doesn't just give you the ability to scale on demand. The biggest thing it gives you is the ability to get rid of many of the management concerns. It takes you from having 12 boxes, all of which do 12 different things, to having one box for tunneling, and someone else takes care of almost all of the rest of it, besides what specific policies you want to push through. And all of the upgrades, all of the capacity planning, all of that is handled by somebody else.
We can hope.
We can hope.
I mean,
it seems to work very well for web services.
It does, but the thing about web services is we've actually built monitoring tools for them.
Right.
And engines that tell us performance and capability and whether there's available, you know, all that sort of stuff has been possible because of Linux.
Well, a lot of this you can now run on Linux, right? It's all software. You run it in the cloud and... But I do think that there's maybe a general theme that you and I keep coming back to in this talk, which is that monitoring tools, tools for testing, a lot of these sort of infrastructure management tools that we're used to having in traditional software aren't quite there yet for networking infrastructure. And we need that in this world where you know, all middle boxes are not 12 different boxes that I bought from 12 different vendors. They're a set of software services that I'm running in a rack that have, you know, software updates that are scheduled using something like OpenStack that I can test and I run a testing suite on before I deploy a new patch or something like this. Like all of these things that seem incredibly obvious, we just don't have.
But we do have them for operating systems.
Right. We have them for
operating systems. Now, the flip side of this, of course, is that for every router, there's 1,000 servers kind of argument. Right? They operate at a different scale. So the problem there is much larger, and so we solve the problem where that was most painful. But in networking, you know, people are still struggling with Python and Ansible to do systems provisioning.
Problem is really much larger? I mean, I think any small problem is likely to have more impact because more users have to interact with that service.
Okay, we're really...
yeah.
I'm loving this conversation, although it's a little off track. So if you're listening, it's fine. No, and it's very interesting to talk because you've got a very research-focused type of aspect, which I really am enjoying. So I just wanted to apologize to the audience that we're sort of wandering around into a discussion because it makes sense to do so. My firm belief is that we're still not monitoring the network in any viable, practical way. We don't have analytics. We don't have telemetry. We don't have automation. So just basic levels of automation. We cannot upgrade routers reliably at that level. If I want to load firmware onto a commercial router of some sort, there's actually very little chance that it will reliably do so, like maybe a 50-50 shot, right? Or if it runs out of memory, it will just die and crash because the operating system inside of those devices isn't protecting its memory or if I configure something and I configure it something obviously wrong, it will blithely go, sure, I'll let you take the entire network down, boom.
Done.
Right? And we don't have any of that instrumentation. And yet in operating systems, we have, Chef, Puppet, Ansible, SaltStack. We have Docker, Kubernetes, Mesosphere. We have all of these tools to prevent exactly those situations. And yet in networking, we don't. And that's, to me, the middle box problem is exactly that.
Right.
Yes, so every day I do something, I have to take a fully trained, certified, qualified engineer to do the most mundane, mind-numbingly, tediously dull tasks.
Right.
Like add a rule to a proxy server, because only somebody who has 5 years' experience of configuring a proxy server and training in networking and TCP and HTTP and browsers and JavaScript can configure one of these things. That's nuts.
That's
if
absurd.
I get into a car, I go for 10 hours of driving lessons, and then I'm driving the car. The only time I need an expert is once a year when I take it to a mechanic who has specialist tools, think CLI, who has specialist testing routines, who has, you know, blah, 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 and spare parts to be able to make that thing go. I should not need a fully competent mechanic just to do day-to-day driving of a car.
Right. The outsourcing argument, I think there's two things that address this. The outsourcing argument says, sort of makes the distinction between the mechanic and the driver, that the mechanic can handle most of the tasks and the driver really just has to manage the tunneling to or from their third-party provider. Mm-hmm. And then if you are the mechanic, you really want better tools. And so this means, you know, your OpenStack equivalent for NFV infrastructure. This means better testing. This means better monitoring. A huge part of my thesis work is about building better fault tolerance tools so that you can actually have automatic failover that guarantees correct and reliable recovery of lost state. It just doesn't exist. And so, you know, we need tools like this for those mechanics who are actually implementing the nitty-gritty nuts and bolts of making the infrastructure run.
And that's the piece that's missing at the moment, is this operational focus, I think.
Mm-hmm.
And this is where Domain 2.0 actually gets its value to me from, coming back to the AT&T discussion
earlier.
Is they're less focused on what forwards the packets or what creates the network, and much more focused on tools like ONOS and CORD and operating and OAM and OSSBSS and integrating with the invoicing systems that carriers use because God knows where the money's going to come from, than they are in, you know, they're focused on NFV, not because NFV is something magical. It's just, it's a way to cut costs out of the network. I don't want to buy hardware devices where I have to hold spare parts in a warehouse all over the country to be able to ship it out to site. I want to be able to just have them as VMs so I don't have to do a truck roll every time one breaks down.
Right. And I want to have all this testing, monitoring, provisioning infrastructure that's implemented in a generic way, not 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 times for all of my 5 different NF devices.
That should not be... You know, yeah. It should not be what it is today, which is...
Right, right.
You know, anyway...
So there
you...
are all these competing frameworks. And I've to be honest, I've lost track. There's the... There's AT&T's eComp. Mm-hmm. There's the open...
There's a new open foundation every week.
Yeah, there's... And they don't seem to be pushing out a lot of software.
Well, I think...
It's you out of Berkeley.
The saddest part for me is the failure of... You know, the IETF or the IEEE to be the choice for these platforms. Does that make sense?
Well, it's because Etsy started it rather than the IETF, but the IETF is much better at the technical part. We did one of these Etsy processes, and it was not as so for the fault tolerance algorithms that we designed, Etsy put out a draft describing the algorithms. And, you know, the draft is out there, but I think that the IETF standardization process would have been a lot more robust in terms of the technical feedback and what would be required to make it run on the ground.
But the IETF made a mistake. They said, we don't want to have anything to do with SDN, go away. Software has no part to play in the network. Get the hell out of here. Literally.
Yeah.
So, you know, the art of common sense in the IETF is probably missing.
Mm. I have respect for the IETF. I think they make...
I have respect for the people in the IETF, but in the same way that I might respect a person, but when they get together with their friends, I don't respect the group. That's pretty much how I feel about the IETF. They lack common sense. They're still farting around with IPv6 standards. They change it every other week.
All right.
Do you know what I mean?
We're going to file this away among lists of other things that we're not going to argue about on this talk, although we have a long list.
Yeah. Maybe we can get together and have another one next month.
No. I'm sending other people to
Well, you can come along too, if by all means. But, I mean, the point of the show is to have a discussion about topics that are set around the future of networking.
Yeah, yeah.
So, Justine, please tell people where they can find you on the internet.
Yes, if you find me on Twitter at Justine Sherry, and that's JustineSherry, and I'm Googleable. I have an academic homepage, not a LinkedIn, that has free links to all of my articles. If anyone ever tries to charge you for an academic computer science article, do not pay for it. It should be free on the author's homepage. That's my one diversion there. never pay for academic computer science articles. They should be free on the author's homepage. And all of my articles are free on my homepage.
Thank you so much for putting up with me today. I really appreciate it.
It was really fun. Thank you so much.
I hope you take everything in the sense of it's a discussion and hopefully contributing something back to the
people.
No, it was
delightful. It was really delightful. Thank you so much, Greg.
You should absolutely check out Justine's show homepage at cs.berkeley.edu. I've put a link for it in the show notes. As she says, easily Googleable. Her name sounds exactly like she says it, so it's not hard to find. Good research papers, do read them. I have spent many hours mulling over their impact before I got a hold of Justine to come and talk about it on the show. Thanks so much to her for doing it. That's it for today's show. As always, you can find more about today's show on the website at packetpushers.net. There's show notes. I've tried to put in as many links as I can as possible. If you've got any comments, please feel free to leave them on the blog post that accompanies this show. And if you ever want to share something with the community, you too can come to to packetpushers.net and contribute something there. We'd love to have you join and blog on our platform so that you can reach people in the community and share your knowledge, share your expertise. Don't forget that Packet Pushers is on the Twitter, is at Packet Pushers, where we've got pages on Facebook and on LinkedIn. You can follow us there and you can hear more about what we're doing and all of the different content that we push out. And if you've loved today's show, please, please leave a review on iTunes or tell your friends about us. It's absolutely how we survive and how we get bigger. The bigger we are, the more able we are to survive and keep bringing great content like this to you. But as always, remember that too much networking would never be enough.